Case number 213398, Jamal Murray versus the State of Ohio Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation et al. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Bradford, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. I am Tracy Bradford of the Ohio Attorney General's Office, and I'm legal counsel for the defendant, Dr. Timothy Hyde.
Good morning. Just to let you know, you're kind of looking 45 degrees away from the camera.
Is that better?
Yeah, that's I know all of us struggle with this stuff.
I apologize.
That's fine. It's all right. Well, do what you're comfortable with, but in any event, you can
yeah, like everything all together, it just fits that way on my desk. I apologize.
You don't have to apologize.
I would like to save 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Sure.
Thank you. The plaintiff brought this case as a Section 1983 civil rights case alleging that Dr. Hyde was deliberately indifferent to his medical care. On summary judgment, the court below denied Dr. Hyde qualified immunity. Qualified immunity shields government officials performing discretionary acts or functions from civil damages. The burden is on the plaintiff to show that Dr. Hyde violated a right so clearly established that every reasonable official in his position would have clearly understood that he was under an affirmative duty to refrain from such conduct. Plaintiff has not met this burden. We have to ask ourselves a couple of questions to see if Dr. Hyde is entitled to qualified immunity. Did Dr. Hyde violate a constitutional right held by the plaintiff? If yes, was it clearly established at the time of the actions in question? And would a reasonable official in Dr. Hyde's position clearly understand that the medical treatment he was providing to inmate Murray violated the Constitution? It has to have been violating the Constitution. Not that it fell below a certain standard of care, but that it was, in fact, unconstitutional. It cannot be that the care was simply less than the standard of care evinced by the requisite medical community. It must be that he subjectively knew the care he provided or withheld presented a serious risk to the inmate, and that he consciously disregarded that risk.
Well, Ms. Bradford, we get these cases all the time, so I think you can just tell us about the facts of the case and why you think they meet or don't meet the applicable rules.
So we are facing appealing a question of law for the court. We feel that the right was not so clearly established that Dr. Hyde would have known that the actions he was taking were in fact unconstitutional. At most.
We have a lot of case law in this circuit dealing with similar questions. Murray was on a prescribed plan of treatment. Richmond says an interruption of a prescribed plan of treatment, if you know about that, can be a constitutional violation. How is your case different than Richmond, or is Richmond not clearly established, or is Richmond, kind of looks a little bit like negligence to me, but what do you have to say about Richmond?
Good question, Your Honor. First, the Richmond case was decided in 2018 after the incidents in question. However, it did rely on the decision announced in Terrence, which was a previous case, so it relied on that case. I think the cases relied on to establish the clearly established right, of which Dr. Hyde should have been aware, are very factually different than the case you have at hand. A couple of really important differences. In Terrence, in Boretti, and in, there was another case, Comstock, the inmates at question were in face-to-face contact in various situations with medical providers that actually declined and did not or refused to provide medical care to an inmate. Notably in Terrence, he was in an institutional hospital at the time. So he was under 24-hour supervision of the medical providers. He relied on them for his movements, for what he could and could not do, for recreation and so forth. They knew about the medication he was taking. They knew the side effects of certain things that would interfere and cause serious health concerns to him, including dehydration, activity in high heat levels and so forth. And they totally disregarded all of these facts.
Let me ask you this. Dr. Hyde was Mr. Murray's treating physician, was he not?
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right. He knew that it was recommended that he maintain a certain level of what they call what, INR, between 2.5 and 3. He knew on December 22 of 2011 that he was down to 1.3. a lot lower than the recommended level, and yet he didn't do it. The last test that was done that showed the 1.3 on December 22, there was no follow-up testing until he had Mr. Murray had his stroke on February 6th of the next year. Isn't that a violation of, couldn't that a jury find that was deliberate indifference to a serious medical need?
We have to look back for qualified immunity as to what the law that was clearly established at the time, and would someone in Dr. Hyde's position in fact know that the medical treatment he was providing was actually unconstitutional, that it deviated from some standard of care. And I don't think that it did.
Well, our case law says that, quote, if you knew of and disregarded an excessive risk to the prisoner's health or safety, that is a constitutional violation. And that was the law prior to 2011.
He would have had to know that the care he was providing violated a constitutional right held by inmate Murray. And I don't think that is the case. If you look at the interactions between inmate Murray, he continued to provide a prescribed plan of care. He continued to provide his medication of Coumadin. He continued to order the INR testing. He did not abandon a plan of care for him.
Didn't the testing stop for something like 4 to 6 weeks, it looks like? His point of view is that there was and I know there are disputed facts about whether he showed up for appointments, but his point of view is, hey, a central part of the plan is I have to be tested for this blood level thing. And that didn't happen for 6 weeks. And ergo, I had a stroke.
Correct. But if you look at, you have to take in the fact, I mean, you can't not take in the fact that the inmate did not, or that failed to appear for certain blood testing. And you have to look at the cases that were relied on by the lower court, the fact that they actually had control and face-to-face contact with the inmate at all times. In this situation, the inmate has to show up at pill call to take his medication. Pill call, med call is 3 times a day for 2 to 2.5 hours. Every day. If you don't show up to take your pill at an institution with 2,800 inmates, you can't absolutely go track down every single inmate and tell them, here's your medication, you forgot to show up to take it, you need to take it.
That dispute, you're raising disputed facts, and we can't do that on this interlocutory appeal. I mean, I'm looking at page 20 of the magistrate's report and recommendation. It says plaintiff, however, has presented evidence disputing defendant's allegations of noncompliance. So you can't argue before us that, well, he didn't comply when he says he did comply. I mean, that's something you have to assume all the facts as alleged by the plaintiff.
What I would say to that, Your Honor, is even if he met the subjective component of a claim of deliberate indifference, that the law was not clearly established. The case law that was relied upon by the lower court to establish the clearly established right, Dr. Hyde, based on those cases, and if you looked at the very specific facts of those cases, he would not be on notice that what he was doing was unconstitutional.
If he had reason to think that Mr. Murray had not been tested for 6 weeks, he wouldn't be on notice that that would fall below a constitutional standard of care.
He did order testing.
He ordered it, but you know, I think the argument for Mr. Murray is that he was indifferent, so to speak, about whether the testing was happening, and that he should have known that Mr. Murray wasn't tested for something like 4 or 6 weeks. The record would seem to allow that, you know, that view of the facts. Let's say the record does support that view of the facts. Why isn't that a clear enough violation of the plaintiff's rights?
Because I don't believe, Your Honor, that that is criminally reckless behavior. I think what we have here is a negligence case or a medical malpractice case disguised as a claim of constitutional violation.
Okay. Well,
I mean, you might be right about, maybe that's right, but we have to operate within our case law. And our case law, I mean, you could read some of our cases and say, that looks a lot like negligence, but they called it, you know, criminally reckless conduct. Okay, but maybe you're right about that, but that's our case law. So
again, I don't think if you look at the facts that were relied upon by the district court to determine clearly established right, if you look at the very specific facts of those cases, it is not at all consistent with the facts of this case.
Okay, well,
interactions with between Dr. Hyde and the patient. And you also have to consider.
All right. I think we need to hear from Mr. Klinger at this point, and you'll have your full rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning.
Morning.
The standard I believe that we're dealing with here is whether Dr. Hyde knew of and disregarded an excessive risk to inmate health and safety. That's the standard that was articulated in the Richmond case, citing the United States Supreme Court Farmer case from long ago for that standard. So did he know of and disregard an excessive risk to inmate health and safety? Well, we know that he knew of the danger, Dr. Hyde knew of the danger posed by low INR levels. He admits in his deposition that this brain clot may not have occurred if Mr. Murray's INR levels had been kept within the range. He admits that could have been the case. We know that he knew that the INR level was 1.3 at least by December 28th when there was an appointment. And he reviewed the records and ordered allegedly another blood test. He knew of 1.3, and that test, by the way, had been taken on December 22nd, received by the hospital or by the prison, that is, on December 23rd of 2011. So yes, for 5 to 6 weeks, Mr. Murray's levels went unchecked. And he knew, of course, Dr. Hyde knew of Mr. Murray's history of DVTs, deep vein thrombosis, and he knew that during a 6 week period, no tests had been taken. In fact, we know for sure that he saw, Dr. Hyde saw Mr. Murray on January 31st of 2012 and noted in the record that the PT/INR test was overdue. So presumably he had the chart in front of him at that point, and he realized that there's been a 1.3 level here since December 22nd And I haven't succeeded in getting a blood test since then. Even at that point, on January 31st, Dr. Hyde did not order a stat blood draw or INR test. He simply wrote INR overdue. And we know that 6 days later, Mr. Murray was hospitalized with this brain clot that led to his blindness. Now, our expert, Dr. Goldberg, says in his affidavit, his report, that Mr. Murray was in fact very compliant with his medications, as far as the records show. He missed no Coumadin doses during the entire month of January 2012. He did miss, Dr. Goldberg notes, for unknown reasons, his Coumadin on February 5th and February 6th. Well, that was the day before and the day of Mr. Murray's excruciating headache that caused him to lie on the floor and have his cellmate call for the nurse. And then he was finally able to get some serious medical treatment. And of course, on the 6th, he was diagnosed with a blood clot. So, and of course, Dr. Goldberg attests that were it not for that low level of INR for that 5 or 6 week period, the blood clot would not have occurred, that directly caused the clot.
Can I ask you a question? Is there some sort of standard interval on which you're supposed to test for the INR levels? Like, why is 6 weeks unreasonable? I mean, maybe it is, but like, is there some reason to believe that it's supposed to be tested every 2 weeks, every 1 week, every 4 weeks? What?
Yes, it looks like the history from Dr. Hyde, beginning in November of 2011, when he began treating Mr. Murray, it looks like he was ordering blood tests at an interval of 2 weeks for a couple of months, two or three weeks. And then on December 28th, he ordered a blood draw for 10 days later. I shouldn't say he ordered it, because there's really no order in the record. He noted in his chart that there should be a blood draw in 10 days, but there's no record anywhere that an order was issued or that there was any blood draw ordered for 10 days later, which would have been approximately January 7th. The next
if I could just interject for a moment, yes. Would there typically be a record of those sorts of orders?
I believe there would typically, in his deposition, Dr. Hyde was asked, did you order a test for 10 days later? And he said, well, I don't see an order, but I put it here in the chart. So I guess an order is a separate piece of paper that nobody has located.
Okay.
And there's no indication of a no-show on an appointment of any kind on January 7th or 8th or around the 10-day interval. The next indication we have is January 18th, when Mr. Murray allegedly missed a call. And we don't know if he did miss a call for a blood draw on January 18th. We really don't know why. We don't know if he ever got the message that he was supposed to be there. There's some indication that a nurse called a couple of times for him to come. We don't know if he was out of his cell, if he was sick. There's no indication. All we know is it didn't happen and nobody followed up. Dr. Hyde didn't follow up. And as I said, even on January 31st, Dr. Hyde noted that it was overdue, but didn't really do anything immediately to look into the problem, and no adjustment, of course, was made in his medication. Now, I believe that you can fairly read this fact pattern to be similar in a fair way, looking at it fairly, to several of the cases that have been decided by this court in the past, including the Richmond case, which again was, of course, 2018, but relied on earlier cases. And in that case, the court said the doctor must provide medical treatment to the patient without consciously exposing the patient to excessive risk, serious harm. And in that case, the doctor who was held liable ordered bandage changes every day or twice a day. There was a question of fact as to whether he actually looked at the chart so that he would know whether his orders were being carried out. But this court denied immunity because there was a question of fact about whether he had reviewed the chart. We don't really have that question of fact here. There's really no question that Dr. Hyde knew of the 1.3 and knew in January 31st that it wasn't being tested. But in the Richmond case, the court said that the doctor took no steps to ensure that his order regarding dressing changes and pain medications would be implemented every day as prescribed. So he prescribed the bandage changes, just as Dr. Hyde here ordered INR tests, but he took no steps to see that it was implemented. And that's,
but wouldn't you have to know that it's not being implemented rather than not taking steps to ensure? So if the doctor prescribes something and he says, make sure that he says the patient should take this pill at 8 o'clock every morning, and he knows that the prison distributes the pills. Generally, their policy is to distribute them at 8 o'clock every morning. Like, does he have to like call the prisoner every day and say like, hey, did you get your pill? Or, I mean, if he prescribes it, can he just, is it criminally reckless unless he knows, oh my gosh, that guy's not getting his pills? Why can't he rely on the prison staff to administer the medication?
The easiest way for me to respond to that, Judge Larson, is to say that I don't know the answer to that. Certainly it's not reasonable to expect a doctor to check every day. I don't know what kind of follow-up procedures they had. You would think it would be reasonable to have some kind of follow-up, but we do know this, that as early as January 31st, or as late, January 31st, Dr. Hyde saw Mr. Murray, saw the chart, would have known if he looked at the chart that, and we can presume that he did, because he said INR overdue. So 6 days, that was 6 days before the diagnosis of the blood clot, when the pain got so bad that Mr. Murray couldn't stand it anymore at all. So at least by then he knew. And even then, he could have, presumably, ordered an INR right then. Let's get this done now. He simply said INR overdue. And he didn't schedule a blood test for the next day or the day after. In fact, I can't tell you offhand when he did, if he did issue an order at all. The next thing we really know is that Mr. Murray had his blood clot. So no, I don't believe a doctor should be expected to follow up every day on something like that. But yes, in this case, with an INR of 1.3, with Mr. Murray's history, and with what Dr. Hyde understood to be the dangers of low INRs, I think it certainly shows deliberate indifference for him to see him with, by the way, some of the symptoms that Dr. Goldberg says are indicative of a brain blood clot, to see him on the 31st and then really take no further steps except to say, well, it's overdue. Let's order another draw. That's just as bad as the doctor, certainly worse. The consequences are worse, certainly, than the doctor in the Richmond case, who presumably saw that the bandages weren't being changed and didn't take any obvious steps to change that. So yes, I think he knew. At least by January 31st, he knew that there was something that it was very, potentially very dangerous going on, and he took no steps at that point to ensure that something happened immediately to save Mr. Murray. And we know the disastrous consequence.
On February 6th, what was his INR levels in the hospital?
It appears that they took two or three different tests on that day. And as far as I can tell, Judge, they were 1.4, 1.5, and 1.6. I can't explain why there would have been that range, but they were well below the 2.5 that had been recommended back in July and well below the 2 point minimum that Dr. Hyde says he believes in his medical judgment was reasonable. So we have a 1.3 in early to mid-December, and we have a 1.4, 1.5, 1.6 on February 6th, and no indication in between of what the INR was. But we can presume that because Mr. Murray was compliant with his medications all the way up until February 5th, and he was taking the prescribed dosage, that during that entire time, his INR was well below what even Dr. Hyde says would be a minimum safe INR level for a person and the patient in Mr. Murray's condition. I think, Your Honors, that the district court, the magistrate and the district court looked at the facts very carefully, analyzed your prior case law very in a principled way and very carefully. Obviously, there are no two cases that are exactly the same, but and in my reading of this court's jurisprudence on this area of medical treatment, improper medical treatment of prisoners, the standard is simply, did they know of and disregard an excessive risk to inmate health? And we don't have to find a case that's exactly has exactly the same fact patterns. But as I indicated earlier, a fair reading of this court's precedents, also the Wisniewski case, Lamar versus Wisniewski, where a doctor sealed up, ended an exploratory surgery on a patient before he really knew what the problem was, even though he was trying, he just didn't understand it. That was enough to avoid, to deny qualified immunity. So I believe the case was cited correctly below. At the very least, there's questions of fact that the jury needs to be able to look at to decide whether or not this was actually a case of deliberate indifference. But that's our position. Thank you very much for your attention. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Klinger. We appreciate your argument. We'll hear a rebuttal from Ms. Bradford.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I think one thing that is very important for the just to clarify for the court, in the lower court on summary judgment dismissed multiple other defendants, including nurses that had treated the inmate during the month of January. There were five instances in January where the inmate sought medical care and was treated by nurses for a cold, gastrointestinal issues, various ailments that he said he had, a headache, he said he has some sinus issues and so forth. And they did, the court found that they were not at all deliberately indifferent to the inmate's medical care. At no time during that period did he complain at all in January that he was suffering from any type of pain to his lower extremities, which is where he had had previous blood clots. His vision was good. He had no neurological deficits and so forth. They were treating him for the conditions and the that he presented at the time.
Those were pretty serious conditions, though, at the time. I mean, he's got these horrible headaches and he's laying on the cell floor. I mean,
That
I don't think an absence of symptoms is probably going to be the way out for Dr. Hyde here.
What I'm trying to say is during the month of January, except up until January 31st, the medical treatment provided to Mr. Murray was by nursing staff. It was not by Dr. Hyde. And they were treating him for the symptoms he presented at the time. They provide reasonable treatment, and that is what the lower court found. So then you come to January 31st, and he's being seen, and he complains again of gastrointestinal issues. He had a migraine. He had a history of migraines. He didn't complain to Dr. Hyde at all that he he couldn't see, he had any vision problems, that his leg hurt or anything. And Dr. Hyde treated him for the symptoms that he presented at that time. And yes, he also noted that his INR testing had not been completed, and whether or not he did order that testing to be done, I think is not a matter, a settled matter for the court. However, when the inmate came to see a nurse in early February, that is when he complained of shortness of breath. He complained of very different symptoms, that his leg hurt, that he couldn't see, that he had some vision loss, that he was in dire straits and in great amount of pain. Yeah, and that's when he went to the emergency room.
I guess, Mr. Murray's side would probably say that the doctor simply has a different level of responsibility here. Overall sort of supervisory, he's got a strategic level rather than sort of just treating symptoms that present on a particular morning. And that where he fell short here is exactly what he noted in his own, notation on the chart, which was this person had not had this blood test for quite some time, and keeping those levels low, he knew, was critically important to avoiding a stroke. As the record comes to us now, what's the mistake in that assessment?
I think the existing precedence is an official's failure to alleviate a significant risk that he should have perceived but did not, while no cause for commendation, cannot under the Supreme Court's cases be condemned as the infliction of punishment. We're looking at a constitutional violation, not a medical malpractice case. And I think that's exactly what this is. I think there was an inadvertent failure on Dr. Hyde's part to maybe perceive things that he did not.
What didn't he perceive?
I mean, criminal reckless behavior.
Okay, but what didn't he perceive? Because kind of the problem you have here is he did perceive that the testing wasn't being done, and he did nothing. So he perceives it.
I don't think he did nothing.
There's no indication he placed an order, and 7 days later the man has a stroke. So that's not good for the defense here.
I think an inadvertent failure to provide that care is certainly not, does not rise to the level of criminally reckless behavior.
Couldn't a jury find, given the fact that he himself notes that the testing wasn't being done, couldn't a jury find that his failure to order the test or otherwise make the test happen was deliberate? There's no indication that he did a thing after he wrote that down. I'm not saying he didn't do a thing. I'm just saying on this record, that's the way we have to look at it.
You would have to infer that he had wanted behavior. And I don't think that that's the type of treatment that he was providing this inmate. I think he provided consistent care. Whether he was negligent in that care, I think is the true question. And that is an issue that should be decided in a state court, not a constitutional violation that was the intentional infliction of a great deal of harm.
Okay. Well, any further questions from the other judges? No further questions. Okay. Well, Ms. Bradford, thank you for your argument. We thank you both for accommodating the change to a video argument and for your briefs and your help today. Case will be submitted and the clerk may adjourn court.